Hello once again, everybody, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WNC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. In the studio this afternoon to discuss cancer care, oncology, and hematology is Dr. Carl Atkins, Chief of the Division of Oncology and Hematology at St. Peter's Hospital, Albany. Dr. Atkins earned his Doctor of Medicine degree from Tufts University School of Medicine. He joins us today to discuss cancer care, cancer prevention. Dr. Atkins, as always, welcome to the Vox Pop.
Thanks very much.
We're really glad you're taking this time. I know how busy you are. To be part of today's conversation, give us a call, 1-800-348-2551. Again, 1-800-348-2551. Why is it the Division of Cancer and Hematology? Why both?
Well, that's actually a traditional combination. Oncology really started out with treatment of leukemia. Leukemia is a cancer of the blood system. So the first doctors who treated cancer were hematologists, the doctors who took care of patients with blood disorders. Oncology really developed later as doctors who specialized only in the treatment of cancer. And later on, the two disciplines separated. So it's very common for hospitals to have divisions that combine both hematology and oncology.
So, Doc, let me ask you this. Who's, what should, you know, we, for those of us who have Woody Allen disease, which is that we worry about our health a lot, what's the latest thinking? I'm drinking a cup of coffee, good or bad?
Well, I think we really don't have much evidence one way or another. Mm-hmm. And I think it's unfortunate that we get these swings of opinion. We get studies that say, oh, cancer, coffee's bad for you, causes cancer, you get pancreas cancer. Or, oh, no, we have another study that says, no, that's all hogwash and there's really no problem with it. And when you really listen to some of the best epidemiologists, and there was really an excellent paper about this a number of years ago published in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, the careful epidemiologists will tell you there's only so much information we can get out of many of these studies that try to look for some of these risk factors by examining populations. Sure. And we have to be really careful about it. And most of the time, it might be an inkling that we can use for maybe generating a new study. But most of the time, we really should consider a lot of that background noise and not pay too much attention to it.
Well, do you drink coffee?
I do.
Yeah. Me too. I love it. Okay, let's go to John in Kingston. That's what it is. John in Kingston, you're on the air.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. I just had a quick question about the doctor's personal opinion, I guess professional opinion, as it relates to medical marijuana and cancer treatments. I know it doesn't actually treat the cancer, but there's been a lot of studies that I've seen, positive and negative, and I just kind of want to see what your thoughts were.
So marijuana, we know, can have a couple of beneficial effects. One is in controlling nausea related to cancer chemotherapy, and the other is in some people it can certainly improve appetite in certain types of cancers that don't directly affect the intestines or the stomach. We actually do have a drug called Marinol. That's the trade name for tetrahydrocannabinol, the active ingredient in marijuana. So it is available in a pill form. Some people find that maybe they think they get a better effect by smoking marijuana. I'm not sure whether that's because it feels better, but I think that there are some people who get benefit from it. Some people don't. Some people, especially if they are elderly, don't react as well to marijuana as younger people do and can actually get a bad effect from it. I think it has a role to play. I haven't found it to be terribly necessary in my practice, and I think that most of the time I really just don't need to have it available. But I certainly think that there are times when it could be useful.
John, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Alice in Queensbury. Okay, Alice, you're on. Let me give that number, 1-800-348-2551. Go ahead, Alice.
Okay. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
This applies to labels I've seen on electrical appliances, earbuds, and on a hair dryer. Anyway, it quotes California Proposition 65, saying that it contains chemicals known to the state of California to cause cancer and other birth defects, etc., electrical cords and other products. wash hands thoroughly after using. Well, I could be washing my hands obsessively all day long. I have electric coffee pot, hair dryer, and iron. And do you have an opinion on this? Is it really a concern like it's become to me?
I think this probably has more to do with product liability than it really does with true cancer risk. They probably have some data on some very small amount of some component that maybe they tested at 10,000 times the concentration in some mouse or maybe in a cell line. And so the companies don't want to get sued. And so they put these labels on and they say, if you don't wash your hands, it's all your fault. We warned you.
Oh, yeah.
I think that if you want to keep from getting cancer, don't smoke. And I think that's going to be a lot more important than washing your hands when you touch an electrical component.
Do you smoke, Alice?
No.
Good point. Is it the number one risk factor for cancer that we think, smoking?
Absolutely. In terms of numbers, there's just no question about it. It far outweighs anything else.
Yeah. Well, this is very comforting, and that means I can go back to ironing.
Well, Alice, before you do, I want to add on to your question, because it's a good question. And that is, you know, you're watching Law & Order, which I do a lot, third, fourth, or fifth time, and on comes, you know, some ad for a drug. And afterwards, they tell you all of the things that could kill you about that drug. Is that the same thing you're talking about now?
Well, I think that's sort of a different concept, and there's all this controversy about direct-to-consumer advertising, which is what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So those are regulations that are required by the FDA. If you're going to advertise, you have to tell them all about those side effects that are listed in the product label. And some of those are certainly of concern, but mostly it's a matter of, hey, these are potential side effects. You've got to know about these before you take the medication. Most of those are things that if your doctor is going to give you the prescription, the doctor may not even mention them because the side effects are so infrequent.
Have you ever had a medication that you consider to be, you know, good medication, and then it just turns out not to be good?
Not to be good.
In other words, something that really gets taken off the market.
I had a chairman of my service, a chairman of the Department of Medicine, when I was an intern and resident. He had a saying. He used to say, snidely, that you have to use a new medication within the first 5 years of it going on market before it loses its effectiveness. So obviously he was trying to say you have to be careful about new drugs, because very often you do find out about problems about them that you don't know about when they first are put on the market. And there's a reason for that. You know, even though drugs are extensively tested before they go on market,
they don't go to a million people.
They don't go to a million people. That's exactly right. So, there are things that get out there. I tend to be very conservative about new drugs, and so I tend not to be the first one to use them unless there is some very compelling data about them. So for drugs that I've used, I can't think of one that I've been out there and said, great, I'm going to prescribe this, and all of a sudden I said, wow, uh-oh, I'm going to stop prescribing that because it got pulled off the market.
That's very good. Thank you very much. Thanks, Alice.
Well, thank you both very much.
Right.
Bye.
And we'll go to Susan in Northfield. Susan, 1-800-348-2551. Go, Susan.
Good afternoon. I have a relatively significant family history of cancer. My mother passed away of colon cancer, a sister of breast cancer at age 42. My brother is battling stage 4 colon cancer now at the age of 52. How often should one be checked, given the family history, as far as colonoscopies go?
So it depends on exactly what's going on with the family history and who in the family has it. Generally, when we hear a pretty significant family history, there are a couple of things that will go on. Sometimes we will actually recommend that someone see a genetic counselor to go through it thoroughly and try to find out if there is a specific familial syndrome that needs to be identified. And there are tests that can sometimes be done to determine that. Often, if it's a familial colon cancer syndrome, we recommend that someone have a routine colonoscopy started 10 years prior to the age at which it's seen in other individuals in the family.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But, you know, your history sounds pretty significant, and it's the kind of thing that often we would recommend genetic counseling about.
Okay.
Well, on top of that one, if I have a, colonoscopy,
mm-hmm.
And they say, okay, see you again in 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
But then, are there colon cancers that can grow real fast within those 5 years that you don't catch because you wait too long?
So the rationale for waiting 5 or even 10 years between colonoscopies, assuming the first one is normal, is based on data that have shown that it takes about 8 years for development of a new of a cancer from a polyp.
A polyp.
And so if you don't have a polyp, it takes a little while for a polyp to develop, and then it should take at least 8 years for a cancer to develop from that. And there have been pretty good studies to show that, 10 years probably even is enough for a screening interval. The problem is that all of us have seen patients who've had a normal colonoscopy and then well within that five-year period have wound up being diagnosed with colon cancer.
Mm.
And I think we have to recognize that nobody's perfect, no exam is perfect, and that it's possible to have a colonoscopy and have something in the colon that, just isn't seen because there may be a hidden spot, there may be something that just gets missed. Those things can happen. And I think that you have to distinguish between what's right from a population standpoint and what's feasible. Sometimes you just can't quite get everything right. That doesn't mean that everybody should have a colonoscopy done every year.
Yeah. And the virtual stuff where they do it by computer?
We just don't have that nailed down yet to say that it's equivalent to a colonoscopy.
How about both?
Oh, I don't think there's any additional benefit of doing both. But
okay,
I think that
the human eye, I'm thinking about what you said, the human eye could miss something, but the virtual
colonoscopy can miss it too. And I think that I think that if someone could not have a colonoscopy for some reason, but could tolerate a virtual colonoscopy, that would be an alternative.
Hey, Susan, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Right. We're going to take a very short break. If your name is Howard or Irene, stay right there.
Support for WAMC comes from St. Francis Hospital and Health Centers, Poughkeepsie, serving the healthcare needs of the community, including trauma and emergency care, wound healing, and hyperbaric medicine. sfhospital.org. Snow Farm, Williamsburg, a New England crafts program offering creative arts workshops taught by master craftspeople for adults and teens, beginners and up. Snowfarm.org. Paradise Copies, Northampton, providing printing design for customers for over 20 years, from digital to offset, color copies, scans, logos, and more. ParadiseCopies.com. Albany Pro Musica, performing John Brown's body, works from and about the Civil War, including Raff Vaughn Williams, Donut No Bees Pack'em, Saturday, June 9th at MPAC, albanypromusica.org. And McCabe and Mack, attorneys at law, Poughkeepsie, providing legal services for homes, families, and businesses throughout the Hudson Valley, mccm.com.
And we are back with our wonderful guest, Dr. Carl Atkins, Chief of the Division of Oncology and Hematology at St. Peter's Hospital in Albany. Okay, so I just wanted to follow up for 1 second with this last thing. You say most colon cancers come from polyps, right?
Correct.
But there are other kinds of colon cancer other than polyp-related, aren't there?
Extremely rare. So the vast majority of colon cancers are what we call adenocarcinomas.
Right.
And adenocarcinomas do start from polyps.
Yeah.
That's about 95% of colon cancers.
Plus, if you're in that 5%, my friend just passed over in Martha's Vineyard, and he had one of the rare ones.
Yeah. Right. But it's just not feasible to screen people for more rare types of colon cancer because you're going to be doing colonoscopies on normal people unnecessarily.
Do any of them ever occur on the outside of the colon as opposed to inside?
Well, we wouldn't call that a colon cancer.
I see.
You could get a different type of cancer.
Metastasized in women who have ovarian cancer.
Yeah, you could get a sarcoma that starts on the outside part.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Howard in New Paltz. Howard in New Paltz, you're on.
Hello, how are you?
Good. You don't mind my saying?
I have a couple of questions. One is, do you think that cancer is kind of become a huge business for drug companies?
Well, I think certainly a lot of drug companies are making a lot of money off the treatment of cancer. That's certain. I mean, drug companies are businesses. No question about that.
Howard, why do you ask?
That's part of my question, is cancer a big business?
Yeah, so your answer was, cancer is a big business.
We're living in a country that has a capitalist economy, as virtually all countries in the world do now, and where there's a disease that can be treated and where the treatments have costs associated with them, and somebody has to make something that is a product that gets paid for. I mean, there's a business. Insurance companies are businesses, too.
Well, yes, and I don't like either of them. Howard, thank you for the call. Appreciate it.
I have something else I could add to that, if you don't mind.
Well, as long as it's within the realm of civility, sure.
Yeah, it's... you can't get more civil than what I just asked.
Okay, go ahead.
I had a doctor years ago. I was diagnosed with something about 40 years ago.
Yeah.
And his name was Emmanuel Ravisi.
No, forget it. We don't want to hear the names. Go ahead.
No. He's dead.
I don't care. Go ahead. You had a doctor years ago. That's enough. Go ahead. What do you got about it?
Okay. He spoke 11 languages, and they called him a quack. He invented things for oil refineries. I was his patient. I met 35 of his patients that he saved without chemotherapy or radiation. And yet they came down at him as a quack.
Well, maybe he was.
A quack to who? To who? To the medical profession or to the... I mean, who is he a quack to? Not... he was saving people's lives without killing them with chemotherapy. Basically is what it was.
Well, that's... You know, how do we know that?
Well, you could look up his history.
My dissertation advisor, Dr. Padilla, used to say... old Yiddish expression for example, stinks. In other words, these are aggregate.
All I can say is that I'm a witness to it, and you can look it up on whatever.
Okay, Howard, you're great, and I thank you for the call, and we understand where you're coming from. Thank you.
I just want to put that out there.
Yeah, and so you have. Thank you, Howard.
Thanks a lot for listening.
Let's go to Irene in Saugerties. Okay, Irene, you're on.
Hi, I just had a question for the doctor. My husband was healthy his entire life until last May, and the end of May he was diagnosed with AML, leukemia, and by Thanksgiving he was gone. Now, he had been treated at one of the hospitals in Albany and was in and out of there from May till November when he passed away. And I'm concerned about my sons. We don't know where this came from. He lived the healthiest lifestyle of anybody I ever knew.
Well, that's very typical for AML.
What is AML?
It's acute myelogenous leukemia. Mm-hmm. So it usually is not hereditary. There's usually no particular thing that makes it come on. There are some very rare agents that can incite it, like exposure to a chemical called benzene. But for most people,
benzene.
It just comes
isn't
out of the blue.
Isn't benzene one of the chemicals they use in the fracking process now?
It could be, yes.
Yeah. Okay, I just mentioned it.
But it happens. It the incidence goes up as people get older. And so it's not uncommon to see in people in their 60s.
Yeah, he was just 69 when he passed away.
Right,
I mean, it was 60. Only 6 months ago.
It's a very rapidly progressive disease. The cure rate is lower as you get older. Mm-hmm. And it's not at all uncommon for patients to die within weeks or months of diagnosis.
Oh, my God.
So,
yeah, we were just dumbstruck by it because it came out of nowhere and he was so sick we couldn't imagine what was going on.
And that's very, very common. Your story you're telling is very common for people, for families
now,
of patients suffering from leukemia.
Doc, can you put that one into remission?
Absolutely. But in childhood leukemia, that's ALL, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, the cure rate is in the range of 80%.
Wow.
Whereas in adult acute myelogenous leukemia, it's much lower. It's
yeah, he actually did achieve remission, but just for 4 months.
Right, and that's
only 4 months.
And that's very common. I'm sorry about your loss.
We are, Irene, and I hope you find some peace here. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to 1-800-348-2551. Ketchy of Saugerties, of Sullivan County. Okay, Sullivan County. Go ahead, Ketchy. Oh, Kathy. Yes. Kathy. Okay, gotcha.
Hey, good afternoon, gentlemen. Doctor, I'm a breast cancer survivor. 2003, they found one that I would have not found myself through a self-exam. But the doctor told me it was a very aggressive form of cancer. I was not hormone receptive for the aftercare tamoxifen type of thing. So he gave me his very aggressive, he told me, atomic chemo, and that I would hate him. And I did, and I hated it. But following it, he also had prescribed a course of radiation. By the time I was finished with the chemotherapy, I was like chopped meat. I just couldn't deal. I walked away from the treatment, and that was 9 years ago. I finished the chemotherapy. I'm not suggesting this to anybody else, but I'm merely wondering now. I was afraid that the radiation was just going to devastate me, burn me up, and I had had it. And now I've had no resurgence of the cancer. Would that radiation, was that being prescribed for me just as a really an additional prophylactic measure, perhaps over? Because here I don't have it back.
Well, the most important part of preventive treatment for breast cancer in terms of preventing a recurrence, even an aggressive breast cancer, is usually chemotherapy. The radiation therapy is mostly to prevent the recurrence in the breast. Did you have a mastectomy or a lumpectomy?
I had a lumpectomy.
All right. So the radiation therapy helps prevent recurrence in the breast. There is we now know, a very slight improvement in survival in women who get radiation after a lumpectomy. But it's the chemotherapy that offers the most benefit. So the fact that you've done so well is not surprising, and I don't think you need to worry too much about not completing your radiation therapy. And congratulations on surviving so well.
Thank you. Thank you. And I mean, occasionally, like, I itch in that area, but I just kind of attribute that to, like, some crazy kind of healing, like any old scar.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Wanted to add on to the question. You know, I've often wondered about this, and I've asked 1,000 doctors this. You know, when you go to a doctor and they do a regular examination on you, they basically palpate your stomach to see if they feel a mass, right? Are you with me so far?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Now, actually, Katie, I was asking him, but if you want to chime in, that's great. but okay, so then we know that women are asked to do the same thing on their breasts, right, so that they can find a lump if there is one.
Mm-hmm.
The doctors, I always say, can I do that on my tummy? Why do you have to do it? They say, it's different. How come?
It is very difficult to examine your own abdomen, for one thing. And for another thing, it'd be pretty hard to know what you're feeling for. So when we examine an abdomen, we're looking for enlargement of the liver and enlargement of the spleen primarily.
Uh-huh.
And you kind of have to know what you're doing, and it helps to have the patient take a deep breath when you're doing that. And you're feeling in a different angle as opposed to when a woman examines her own breast.
So a man can't feel a woman can't either, a mass. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not really just a mass you're looking for. You're really examining the liver and the spleen.
Well,
primarily.
That's the best explanation I've ever had. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
If I could add one caveat at the end, thank you, it would be to say to everyone, the mammogram is what saved my life. Everyone, get your mammograms. Keep them up. Just do it.
Doc, you want to respond to that?
I think that mammograms are very helpful for women, certainly aged 50 to 70. And beyond that, I think it's important to discuss the need for mammogram with your physician.
Okay. Thanks, Katie. Appreciate it.
Bye. Yep.
Okay, a lot of people on the phone. Let's go to Helena in West Hurley. Okay, Helena.
Hi there. Dr. Atkins, my question is about some misinformation I think a lot of us people get out here regarding vitamin supplements during cancer treatment. There's a book called The End to Illness by David Arbus, I believe, who talks about vitamin C supplements are like sugar to tumors, which really can scare the hell out of you. So I'm wondering, what should a patient do?
I think, first of all, you should talk to your oncologist. But primarily, we have very little information about what happens when you take vitamin supplements when you're on, when you have cancer or when you're on chemotherapy. Most oncologists take a conservative approach and say, don't take excessive amounts of vitamins, don't take antioxidants, don't take herbal supplements, just for fear that we don't know what's in them, we don't know how it might interact. We know that there are certainly some supplements that have been shown to have interactions with drugs.
So, for example?
St. John's wort, for example. We know grapefruit juice has interactions. So, and we know that some supplements have been found to have adulterants in them, things that are not supposed to be in there, because these are things that are not regulated by the FDA.
How about D? We hear a lot about D.
Yeah, so vitamin D, there has been some small studies suggesting that the low vitamin D levels might have an adverse effect on survival in certain patients with cancer. But I think that different doctors will have different levels of comfort with the degree to which we trust that single study. And I think it's important to discuss it with your individual physician, but I think that I wouldn't characterize vitamin C as sugar candy for cancer.
I think
one wouldn't go crazy over it, but I think there's nothing wrong with taking a multivitamin tablet, but I think in general there's also nothing terrific about taking lots of vitamins and supplements while you're on therapy.
Helena,
how about post treatment? You think one can get on the Wagner that's still with your oncologist?
Yeah, I think you should discuss it, but I don't think that vitamins and supplements are going to be the way to health. But if you have some strong feelings about things, discuss it with your physician. But I don't think it's likely to be good or bad in any direction.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Very quickly, because there's so many people waiting on the phone. Actually, there are two free phones. But how much does the mind have to do with the cure rate?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think we don't know enough about it. But certainly in my experience over the last 30 years, there's certainly things that I have seen. There's no question that when people decide that they've had enough and they want to give up, no question
they
give up sooner.
And the other way around?
And the other way around. When people are pushing hard and they really want to keep going, they go longer. Now, do they last through everything? No. I mean, the old saw that a positive attitude helps, I don't think there's any doubt about that. There's a whole budding field of psychoimmunology, whether the mind can affect the immune system. And there's a whole new interest in how the immune system interacts with cancer. We used to think that was all dead and gone, and really wasn't that important. There now clearly is a lot of importance of the immune system interacting with cancer, and we're just learning that we weren't smart enough to figure it out before, and it's much more complicated than we thought. So there may be something to it, and we really don't know how to get there yet.
Great. Thanks for that answer. Let's go to Joe in Albany. Joe in Albany, you're on.
How's it going? So my mother, she's been cancer-free for 10 years. She had stage 3 colon cancer, and she went through preventative chemo, and we saw her get down to like 90 pounds, and, you know, they were trying to give her medications to get her, you know, hungry, and at the time, we were discussing medical marijuana, even though...
Hey, Joe, were you on before today?
No, I was not on before. Okay. I actually just tuned in and I heard it.
Okay, go ahead.
But I've just been interested, you know, at that time, she never used medical marijuana, but we talked about it, and, you know, I saw a special on Dr. Oz, but I've never heard any studies about the correlation of marijuana use in cancer. I've heard it talked about as a treatment for nausea and helping it, but, like, What about the 40-year study? Has there been I heard about a 40-year study the other day that said it doesn't hurt your lung function if you smoke the joint or day or something, but I don't know how, you know.
Okay, you got, okay, Joe, because we're running out of time here. Doctor?
So is the question whether marijuana causes cancer?
No, I think the question is, can marijuana cure cancer?
I don't think we have any data at all about the beneficial effects of marijuana on cancer progression.
Well, I don't think even negative effects. Like, is there any studies that show that there's a higher correlation, like cigarettes?
No, I don't think we have any data to suggest that either. But don't forget, we have much less information about that. There are many fewer marijuana smokers than there are cigarette smokers.
Yeah, I wouldn't put anything in my lungs. Thanks a lot, Joe. Appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Yep. We're going to take a very short break. We'll be right back. David and Ann, you stay there. For the rest of you, 1-800-348-2551.
Support for WAMC comes from the Hudson Valley Heart Center, providing cardiovascular care throughout the Hudson Valley with services including nuclear, echo, CT angio, and vascular testing to help evaluate cardiovascular wellness. HVHeartCenter.com. Adelphi University's Hudson Valley Center for Graduate Programs in Social Work and Undergraduate Nursing, relocated to the St. Francis Medical Arts Pavilion in Poughkeepsie. Adelphi.edu/Hudson Valley. Fleet Feet Sports, Colony, New York, locally owned retail shop providing footwear and apparel for runners, walkers, and triathletes in and around the capital region. FleetFeetAlbany.com. Laurie Stilwell, CPA, PC, providing tax and accounting services for businesses and their owners in Saratoga Springs and beyond. StilwellCPA.com. And The Linda, presenting the Rocky Horror Picture Show with live shadow cast, The Whippet Outskirts, Friday, June 8th at 8 p.m., thelinda.org.
Wow, all five phones are ringing off the hook. Let's go to, it looks like, David in Hurleyville. David in Hurleyville, you're on.
Hi, yeah. My question was about HPV. I recently read an article in a men's health magazine saying that it could cause cancer of the mouth or of the throat in men. And I was wondering what you've heard about that and how it spreads, what the likelihood is, it age range, and I don't think there's a current test for testing men with HPV. Is that something that stays in your system forever, or does that clear your system with the many different strains that HPV has?
So there's been a dramatic increase in cancer of what we call the oropharynx. So it's the back of the throat, basically, above the larynx. And this is occurring in people who are non-smokers. We used to see head and neck cancer. This is the area in the mouth, the throat, larynx, almost exclusively in smokers. And we've been seeing this dramatic trend, and at first it wasn't clear, and it has become clear now that this is related almost exclusively to HPV, human papillomavirus. We're seeing this among men, women, and you know, there's not much discussion about how that HPV gets there, but HPV is a sexually transmitted virus, and so one can imagine how that might get there.
Now, let me ask you something going on with that. So a doc on here one day said almost everybody who is engaged in sexual activity sooner or later gets HPV. I guess if you're in a monogamous one-person relationship, it's not true.
That's correct. And clearly HPV is related to a number of sexual partners.
Yeah.
It's increased in individuals who have sex with, so men who have sex with both men and women have a higher incidence of HPV than, for example, men who have sex with men. HPV is also seen in anal carcinoma. And so it's increased in men who have sex with men, a higher incidence in men who have sex with men and women. So this is clearly a sexually transmitted disease primarily.
Mm-hmm. David, any follow-up?
I was just wondering, is there what are the ways that you can protect yourself? Is that can you protect yourself the same way from any STD?
That is correct.
And are there any tests that for men?
Well, we can tell if a man has HPV, can't we, Doc?
You're right. You can test the blood for antibodies to HPV.
Sure. But the other interesting part of your question, if I may, is that we now have vaccine for young women for HPV. And there's a lot of talk about giving that vaccine to men, to young boys also. What do you make of that, Doc?
That is correct. And I think that, you know, probably, again, this is a public health issue in terms of how you spend public health dollars. And the question is, how do you target people? Who are the best people to vaccinate? Mm-hmm. Certainly vaccinating young women makes a lot of sense. You can prevent cervix cancer.
Yeah, which we know comes from HPV.
Exactly. And so, you know, do you vaccinate all young men or, and, you know, that's another way to prevent cervix cancer. So, you know, maybe that makes sense. And then, you know, maybe we can reduce the rate of head and neck cancer as well and anal cancer as well.
David, we gave a lot of time to this because it's such an important subject. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's go to Ann and Lee. Okay, Ann, you're on.
Hi. I have a friend. It's actually a friend of old friend's wife who has a breast cancer, who's had it. She has never had remission, and she's been being treated at Women and Infants in Providence, and they've now told her that they can't do any more for her. It's spread to her bones. I'm not sure exactly how much, you know, it's bad. And
okay, so
my friend is looking for help, and I'm wondering about it's hard for me to know how to talk with him because I don't really understand what the prognosis is, if it's treatable, if it's going to be treatable by, you know, Dana-Farber or somewhere else, or if it means that it's beyond treatment. I just, you know, I'm trying to understand what that means.
How can I help you?
Well, I'm just wondering if somebody's, you know, if a hospital says to a patient that they can't help her anymore, does that mean, like, what is she, does that mean she's just going to die?
It's usually, you know, that's a bad message for a patient to receive. And I usually try to make sure that patients don't get that message because even when there are no treatments against the cancer, we can always help patients. So the important thing is to try to give patients the message that you're always helping them. And when the transition inevitably comes in patients who have a disease that can't be cured from an active treatment designed to fight against the cancer cells to what we call palliative care or treatment designed to help improve symptoms, that there shouldn't be a sense that you're not able to help the patient. And one hopes that the patient and the husband can walk away not saying, oh, they told me that they can't help us, but walk away saying, well, they told me that we're changing our mode of treatment and we're not going to take chemo anymore. We're not going to, you know, treat the cancer anymore. We're just treating the patient. And, you know, that's the message that should come across.
Okay. And then I guess, I work at Kropalo, and I, you know, I've done some of their programs, and one of the things I had thought might be helpful to both of them would be to learn some yoga and meditation. But I don't know if somebody with bone cancer, you know, who's got it in their bones, I hear it's extremely painful.
Well, yoga would probably not be appropriate, but, you know,
mindfulness. Meditation, can that help
the pain? Always. But, you know, if, you know, the first recommendation I would have would be for them to go back to the doctor and
but they're going up to Dana-Farber now.
Well, fine, but just to just have an explanation about where things stand and
okay.
what can be done, and that may be more than just treatment against the cancer. There may be some palliative treatment involved.
Okay.
And, you know, focus on what can be done as opposed to just what can be used to fight the cancer.
And thank you for calling.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Aaron in Schenectady. Aaron, we're in our final round here, so the faster we go, the better. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Thank you, doctors. My question is, unfortunately, I have a debilitating skin disease, and for the last at least 10 years, they've had me on monthly high dosages of Vicodin. And even before they came out and said that the acetaminophen and the Vicodin is bad for your liver, I was aware of that. And I'm very concerned because both my father and my grandfather had liver cancer. However, my grandfather had hepatitis B, and that's what kind of ate away at his liver. And my father had hepatitis C, and he also had lung cancer. So that cancer did spread through his body. I'm not sure if there's a genetic link, but what are the
and the question, Aaron? Aaron, the question.
What are the substitutes for pain relief other than taking Vicodin or hydrocodone and taking all this acetaminophen and ruining my liver?
So we certainly don't recommend chronic narcotic therapy for benign diseases. And I would recommend that you seek out a pain specialist to talk about other options for managing your pain.
Okay. And with the kind of GI side effects that hydrocodone usage can cause as far as constipation and things like that, I'm 38. I'm going to be 39 this year. How soon should I start looking into colonoscopies? And am I at an age where I should have it earlier because of my condition?
No, generally, still recommend a routine colonoscopy starting at age 50.
Well,
okay.
Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks.
All right.
Okay. And to Rose in Monroe, New York. Hey, Rose, the faster we go, the better. Go ahead.
Yes, doctor. I was just wondering, what is the difference or which one is better? Is the colonoscopy versus a sigmoidoscopy?
Well, it's actually an interesting question, Rose. It's been a hot controversy. Most people these days recommend the full colonoscopy. There are some contrarians out there who suggest that sigmoidoscopy may be a reasonable alternative for screening, since you can pick up most cancers with a screening sigmoidoscopy. It's much simpler, it's cheaper. From a public health standpoint, again, in terms of dollars spent, sigmoidoscopy might be reasonable. It can be done by more physicians. It's cheaper, maybe fewer side effects. But colonoscopy does visualize the entire colon.
Gold standard.
And it really is the best.
I had heard an advertisement, I guess it was today, about that. And I know that I myself am overdue for my colonoscopy. Why? Because of the preparation is so awful.
Yeah.
You don't want to do it, you know?
You join my wife.
They said that the sigmoidoscopy prep is better, but that it is less awful, I guess. But that it only takes the bottom portion of the colon.
Right.
Is that true?
That is correct. It only gets a very small portion of the colon.
So, Rose, if you're listening to the doctor, I think what he's saying is that most of the cancers that we pick up are in that position, in that first section. But that if you really want to go for it, you go for the big one. Thank you, Rose. Let's go to Judy. Oh, I see. I thought that was Rose. It wasn't. It was Dr.'s cell phone. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Okay, so let's go to Judy in Middlebury, Vermont. Okay, Judy, you're on.
Hi, thanks very much. I wanted to ask about a few stories that I've seen recently, mostly in the New York Times, that were very disturbing, about unexplained and unanticipated shortages of not very uncommon drugs, and some drugs that are actually the standard treatment for some diseases, including some forms of cancer, where suddenly they just aren't available and people.
Okay, Judy, and only in the interest of time, because I see the doctor nodding his head, let's let him answer the question. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's a serious problem that has come about, and we're primarily talking about generic drugs. So these are drugs that are very low cost, and because of that, they have a very low profit margin. And sometimes they're produced only by one company. And if there happens to be a problem with the manufacturer, the FDA may say, hey, you got to fix something. And
if you just put the phone over there, we don't get that. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, no problem. Don't forget it, though. Okay.
And if there's a problem, you know, that it's not worth their cost to fix it. And so we get shortages in supply. This is going to be a problem in a country where, again, you know, costs and profit margins are an issue. And unless somebody is out there who wants to spend money and not worry about getting a profit return, it's going to be hard to see how this is going to get fixed unless somebody is willing to say, oh, we're going to pay more money for a drug than is currently in the system.
One wonders if there's any kind of governmental way of correcting that. In other words, of saying, no, you guys are in business. You got to do this.
Yeah, I think Congress is working on that now, but, yeah. You know, our Congress seems to be stuck on lots of things.
Oh, please. Come back and we'll have a political Vox Pop talk. thank you, Judy.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Yeah. Let's go to Stephen in Utica, New York. Stephen, we're going fast. Go ahead.
Hi, Doctor. I have a question regarding surgeries. Individual that I've known was diagnosed with a polyp that was not normally going to be removed other than through a surgical procedure. When they went in to do the surgery, they actually couldn't find this enlarged polyp that needed to be removed. He has been free of any issues since that, which was at least 6-7 years ago. I've also heard of a number of other individuals who've had similar situations where they've done exploratory and not able to locate the lesion. Can you comment on the occurrence of surgeries that were basically were unable to locate any of these lesions?
Are you talking about a polyp in the colon?
It was a polyp in the colon, yes.
Yeah, that's not something I've really...
Well, gastrointestinal, not necessarily the colon area, but it was gastrointestinal.
So, you know, colon polyps are usually something that they don't have problem locating unless they're really very minute. Small intestinal polyps are hard to diagnose initially because it's a hard area for us to get at, and those could be much more difficult to find at surgery because that's a huge organ, the small intestine. So that's something that I could imagine to be a much more difficult problem. And, you know, we sometimes worry, you know, if you have a polyp, you don't know whether it's cancerous or not, if it might be bleeding, that was the cause for even looking for it. That would be a reason for exploring. And then there's always the potential you're going to go in and not be able to find it. This is a very rare problem.
There used to be in the old days, you know, these things it was coming along where they gave you a diagnostic pill which went into your gut and you could follow it on a TV screen.
Yeah, we still have that. We call that a camera. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Are we seeing, because I heard a lot more about it than I've been hearing in recent years. Has it not really worked out the way we wanted to?
No, we still use those. If we have a patient, for example, who has gastrointestinal bleeding and we can't diagnose it with a colonoscopy and an upper endoscopy, we will do the camera.
Hey, Stephen, thank you for the call. You know, one of the things that occurs to me, Doc, is that you used to hear about open surgeries all the time, exploratory surgeries. They're far rarer now, aren't they?
They are far rarer because of the advent of the CAT scan, for one thing, so that we can see things on CAT scan. We can biopsy things through CAT scans now, and we can do laparoscopies.
How can you biopsy through a CAT scan?
Well, we do a CAT scan, and we use a needle.
Oh, I see.
If we have a patient in the radiology suite, the radiologist can see it, or we can use an ultrasound, the same thing.
You know,
and just put a needle right in
the area. Gastroscopy, endoscopy, you got all that stuff, right?
We have amazing tools.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. Oh, Michael, are you there? No, not yet. Okay, Michael, you're on. Go.
Yeah, hi. I have multiple myeloma. I was diagnosed when I was 44. I'm 51 now. And I was at one cancer center here in New York who closed down a couple of years ago and followed my doctor to another program. After 3 or 4 years being asymptomatic.
Hey, Mike, we're going to be out of. You're going to hear the music in a minute, so you got to ask the question. Go ahead. What's the question?
I'm wondering. It might be too specific. I'm wondering if you have any knowledge of the chromosome abnormalities, deletion 13, P414 and 1Q21 and having the three of those and how they work together.
Well, I mean, what's your question about the abnormalities?
I have them.
Okay.
Well, listen, we are, Michael, I really want to apologize, but we are out of time, and I am so sorry. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you. Okay, so anyway, that is the Vox Pop for today. I told you, I warned you about the music, and there it is. Now, when I find this page, we're all right. I want to thank everyone who called in. Okay, I'd like to apologize to the two people who left on the line. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Support for Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice. Physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. Health-quest.org for locations. Our engineer has been the wonderful Zach Malloy. Our producer is Patrick Donges. Both Patrick and Katie answered the phones today. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update, and I did want to thank Dr. Carl Atkins once again for spending the incredible amount of time he did here with us today. Thank you, Dr. Carl.
My pleasure.